One way we lead in life is by helping others develop faith and testimony. In a world where it seems more and more individuals are questioning their faith, Leading Saints has put together the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit, an online resource that many have found extremely helpful. Just text the word LEAD to 474747, and we'll send you more information about the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit. It's podcast time. You're on the treadmill. You're approaching mile two or three, and you're going to keep going. And what's going to keep you going is this podcast, listening to interesting conversations that will distract you from the hurt and pain of running. So keep going. We believe in you. We're praying for you. Now, if you're new to Leading Saints, this is a podcast where we talk about all things leadership in the context of Latter-day Saint life, right? And so our goal is to help Latter-day Saints be better prepared to lead in as many aspects of life as possible, because leadership is where it's at. There's only one problem in the world, as Elder Seale used to say, Sterling W. Seale is his first name. There's only one problem in the world, and it's leadership. And we hope to talk about it here, because if we can get leadership right in our life, in our world, in every aspect, problems will begin to diminish and go away. That's how important leadership is. Now, in this episode, we have a returning guest, David Osler, who's become such a good friend and mentor. And I consider him part of our board of advisors here at Leading Saints, especially around the content of those that question of faith development, when individuals may experience some term of faith crisis. Dave's really helped me understand these things. He's a former bishop, stake president, mission president, and we've discussed this topic before with Dave, both in the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit, which you can learn more about, and how to listen to those fantastic interviews by going to leadingsaints.org/questioning to see all the details there. But also, he's been on the podcast before. Such an exceptional interview. It's a must listen. You don't have to listen to it before you listen to this one, but definitely after, if you haven't heard his interview where he talks about the power of empathy and listening and understanding, and really just how to minister to those who begin to question their faith. And he has put together, through all his research and time and effort, through much prayer, he's put together a fantastic book that is coming out this August. It's probably out by the time you hear this interview. August of 2019. It's called Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question. And fantastic resource. If you just need a good, solid, like, where do I begin as a leader to understand how to minister to those that are questioning, this would be a great resource, along with, of course, the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit. So we have a discussion on a different aspect, just as far as faith development. Where do you begin? How have societal changes affected belief? You know, we can't just assume that if somebody is having questions in 2019, it was the same as when you had questions in 1980, right? There's different aspects and understandings we need to have to effectively minister to them and simply listen, love, and welcome them into our community with zero expectations of progress or commitment, right? And so he does a great job of dissecting this topic, both in his book, Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question, and this interview. So here's my interview with David Osler, author of Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question. Today, I am sitting down for the powers of the internet with David Osler. How are you, David?
I'm doing great, Kurt.
Good. Well, you are definitely a repeat guest, and I consider you more a part of our organization than a guest, because you've been immensely helpful in various projects, specifically the project of the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit and lining up guests and giving us content and really just guiding us on the topics that we should cover. So I'm glad to have you back.
Thanks. I've really enjoyed working with you, Kurt, and the content you put out is just wonderful.
Cool. Now, nonetheless, there may be some people that are listening who don't know much about your background. And then you've recently written a book called Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question. And so we'll get into that. But just to put you into context for the audience that maybe isn't as familiar with you as I am.
Yeah, I grew up in Salt Lake, you know, a lifelong member of the church. I married after a mission. I went to Japan, Fukuoka, on my mission and loved it. It was a hard mission, but I learned to love the people. It was just great. I came back and went to the University of Utah, met my wife. I guess she was my girlfriend at the time. And then we married and went back east for graduate school. And we ended up in the New Hampshire, Massachusetts area for almost 20 years and took back one little baby and, you know, ended up having a flock of six. by the time we were done with New Hampshire. You know, I've had a rich, wonderful family life, a rich, wonderful life in the gospel. I've served in a number of leadership callings as a bishop, stake president, as a mission president. And now I live, after being abroad for a number of years, live in the Washington, D.C. area as a retired something or other. I'm not sure really what I am, but get to do grandparenting and writing a book and traveling around and, you know, just doing the fun things that this stage of life provides.
That's awesome. And one of those fun things would be writing a book, right? Doesn't everybody do that in retirement?
I had, you know, I'm a business guy. I know how to do PowerPoints and do pro forma financials and write business cases. And, you know, I never thought I would ever write a book, and certainly not one about, you know, the topic that I ended up writing it about.
And we've had some fantastic discussions that everybody listening can actually find those. One is early on, we did a podcast interview, which is phenomenal as far as around the concept of ministering to those who begin to question their faith. Because I think a lot of leaders are, they just don't even know where to start. And so they sort of get into that mode of, well, let me just find the answer to your question, or here's this article, or read this, don't read that. But you do such a good job in articulating, you know, how to approach things with empathy and listening and understanding and those types of things. So I encourage people to check all those interviews out. We also did one during the Questioning Saints virtual summit, which people can find in that library. We'll link to those and delve into them. But maybe just tell us again, like, what first interested you in this topic of those that begin to question their faith?
Well, you know, probably throughout my adult life, I've realized that, you know, everyone is a little bit different and everyone experiences things differently. And so sometimes a one-size-fits-all kind of approach to spirituality and gospel learning. Years ago, my wife and I were called in our stake as church service missionaries, and our task was to reach out to the singles in our stake. And we have a young single adult stake nearby, so all of our active young singles that are, you know, would participate in a singles ward aren't in our stake. So we have about 1,000 singles in our stake, and about 800 of them are not active. So we kind of quickly concluded that knocking on 800 doors and or organizing activities for these 800 people, you know, that don't attend, maybe wasn't the way we could most leverage our impact. And so we, working with our leadership, we decided to ask them why they don't come. So, you know, everyone thinks we know why they don't come, but we wanted to kind of systematically understand why they don't come. And so we sent out letters that gave them links to surveys. We gave them our email address, our phone numbers. Some texted us, some sent us emails. We met with some, went to lunch with people, and kind of talked with them about what the issues were. And even though I think I probably had a greater level of understanding, I found that each time I talked with someone, I learned something new. And I learned that the underlying issues of today and the challenges it presents to faith are really very different than what I thought they were. And it was true as we talked with our leaders. We did some ward councils in each of the individual wards and talked with people. And it was clear that there could be greater understanding around this. And so we prepared some materials. And, you know, I found myself not having a systematic approach to it. So my daughter and my wife, who were kind of maybe a little tired of me talking about this all the time, said, "Why don't you just write it down?" And so I started to write it down. And then it was, maybe this needs to be a book. And so I started on the book last April, thinking about it and thinking, what are the issues and how do we think about them in a structured way? And so that produced the book.
Yeah. And I know with the writing process, as I've, you know, jumped into book projects, like, it's a journey. And it's one of those, like, you don't really know how it's going to end, you know, even though you're not writing a novel, but there's so much you learn and uncover as you go. So what are some of the main highlights that really came to the surface? Because a lot of this happened after those interviews that we initially did. Yeah. So what are some of those principles that came to the surface that you didn't expect?
Well, you know, I'd get stuck on an issue for a long time, you know, and I'd have to think about it. And then I'd write, you know, I became a writer. I'm not really a writer, but, you know, I started thinking and word count. And so I'd write, you know, 5 pages or 1,500 words or something like that. And then I go, this is just garbage, and throw it out because I really didn't understand what the issue was or how to respond to a concern there. And I found that, you know, I had to do a lot of reading. I had to go to people who were smarter and better than me, had to understand their perspective on the concern or the issue. And I found that I really had to open myself up to thinking about those hard issues in a different way. And I was really grateful living in today's age where I could find those issues. If I was writing this, you know, 20 years ago, like I would have had to have gone to a library,
yeah,
you know, and pulled the research. But now you can find so much online and you can access scholars just by email and asking them a question. And many of them will engage because they're pretty motivated to help share their expertise about a problem that they've solved. So I remember there was one topic that I just struggled with really for months. And it, you know, finally kind of came together. And, you know, I certainly prayed. I even fasted about the topic to make sure that I could do my best job of dealing with it and dealing with it in a way that would be helpful for people and help people understand, you know, the issue that I was kind of grappling with.
Yeah. And obviously, though, you know, you were learning different things as you went, I would imagine there was a specific goal that was, you know, on the top of your list that you're trying to accomplish. So, and especially there's more and more books and resources that touch on this topic of those that question and doubt and, you know, faith transitions and so forth. So what was your intent in what did you want to accomplish with writing this?
Yeah, so I am a business guy. So I actually, you know, want to understand whether there's a need for the book and whether the, you know, the things that I wanted to express have been already expressed, because, you know, probably would be expressed better by someone else, someone with maybe academic credentials or the like. And there are a lot of books on the challenges of faith, but in those books, there's very little directed to a believing member to help them understand that doubting, questioning, unbelieving friend, family, ward member. And so I saw a real need to be able to help leaders not have to kind of go through what I did to try and get their arms around what these issues were. And it wasn't just leaders, it's parents, it's family members. And so I felt like there was a real opportunity to be able to bring something that was thoughtful and well-sourced to leaders to help them be able to be more effective against these issues, and for parents to be able to comprehend them with regards to their children or other members of their family.
Yeah. And that takes me to, I was intrigued by even the first line of the book, which is, this book is about us, not about us and them. And it's so easy to sort of get in this mode of seeing people begin to question their faith and sort of saying, you know, that's a tough problem that you're dealing with. But as a community and a culture, like, this is something we all need to address, reconcile, think through, and be better, you know, ministers with, so that we can all overcome whatever challenge it is we're facing.
Yeah. I remember writing that, and the genesis of, you know, that introduction came as I was proofing a number of chapters, and all I was finding were theys and them, you know, they believe this way and they struggled this way. And, you know, this is how you minister to them. And, you know, just the oppressiveness of this us versus them was jumping out of my, through my pages with the way I had written it. And I realized that this really is about all of us. You know, all of us, maybe there's a few that never encounter any questions or never face any, you know, questions of spirituality or faith in their life. But that hasn't been the case for me. Hasn't been that case even with the callings I've had. And in the callings I've had, I found difficult things. I have found things that I've had to respond to. And so I just realized it's not about us and them. It's about all of us together. And the shared identity that we have as the children of our heavenly parents makes it an us, right? You know,
yeah.
We're all loved by them. We all have the same potential, the same hopes and dreams are shared for all of us there. And then when you bring it into maybe a more narrow circle, you know, all of us in a family or an award or that are members of the church, it truly is in us. And so I wrote that and then went through and reworked all the pronouns so that it was generally a we and an us, and as opposed to a you and a them.
And any examples come to mind? Like, I'm just thinking from the perspective of how maybe leaders could adjust the way they talk about this subject. You know, and it's sort of a, you know, where there's so much emphasis on how things are said and words you can use, you know, politically correct and so forth. And I don't mean in that context, but just so we sound more inviting and welcoming to those that wrestle. Any tips or examples of that?
Well, so using we and us is great. But then on the other side, there are a lot of labels that are used towards people who, you know, struggle to stay affiliated with the church. And I think sometimes these labels reduce people to clearly a them. One of the worst ones, in my opinion, is apostate. Mm-hmm. When you kind of go to the dictionary, and I did when I was writing about these labels, you know, apostate is an enemy, someone who is trying to destroy. And in almost all of the settings that I know and the people that I have talked to, people who no longer believe, they are not destructive. They are not trying to tear it down. Now, they may have some anger, and some of it may even be deserved. But generally, when you talk about someone who just doesn't believe in Joseph Smith as a prophet anymore, they're not an apostate. They're not a tear, you know, from the wheats and the tares. They're not anti-Mormon. You know, they're not fallen. You know, they're just us with different beliefs. And so if we ever really in our mind reduce someone to a single word, then they become a them.
Yeah.
And it's so natural in our day and age of, you know, political divisiveness and other sorts of divides in society that we tend to quickly judge someone as outside of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So even words like ex-Mormon, you know, is, you know, maybe someone has left the church and even resigned.
Yeah.
But that label in and of itself doesn't promote a connection of understanding. It promotes a separateness.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of a recent conversation I had with a dear close friend. And you've definitely had some of these conversations where somebody will call you and it's not that they're going through a wrestle with faith or beginning to question themselves, but they've just realized that so many people around them are like some close friends that maybe they've had for years and years in the church. And so it was one of those phone calls where he just needed to vent to me about, man, like, and he sort of jokingly said at the beginning, like, Kurt, is the church still true? I mean, what is going on? You know? And I assured him, yes, I mean, we can delve into the meaning of true and so forth. But to answer your short question with a short answer, yes, it is. And then he said, you know, I talked about, you know, a lot of the principles that you've taught me with showing empathy to these people, loving them. And then he said, yeah, but what if they just start to really break the commandments? And I said, wait a minute, like, aren't we all just breaking the commandments? Like, we're all sinning, you know? And so, like, just realizing that though people are, you know, the old bumper sticker, sinning differently than we are, we're all in that same boat, right? Where some people may be struck with a wrestle with faith and belief, where other is diagnosed with cancer. And that's sort of, you know, in these two different realms where we're becoming sanctified and, you know, praying a different, there in different ways, but in the same way, you know? And so just to bring that, like close that gap of us and them in simple ways of saying, instead of like, they believe, it's like, well, you know, sometimes we all struggle with questions or faith and those types of things, right? And we're all sinning. We're all in this boat of a mortal journey where we're trying to become more like our Heavenly Father, but our journeys are maybe in different realms.
Well, I think you really make a good point. You know, including us with others that have challenges, you know, people we could call them if we weren't our best selves, but identifying with them and acknowledging the commonalities we have of having disappointments or questions or unresolved concerns or whatever, you know, really pulls us together. And you know, again, there's probably very few people that don't.
Yeah.
Even though we dress shiny at church and put our best self on underneath there, you know, there's probably little legs paddling as fast as they can to keep people afloat. And so I think as leaders, being vulnerable about our own shortcomings, acknowledging our own limitations, not only makes us a better leader because then we'll seek help for it, but it also draws people together and helps eliminate the us versus them.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, I love that perspective, just the vulnerability of it. And we've, again, talked a lot about this before, but, you know, when it can start with the leader, like everybody's sort of looking towards the leader for his cadence or her cadence or his or her approach to all this. And when you have a leader, you know, obviously a leader doesn't need to stand up and say, you know, this week I was really struggling with the idea that Joseph Smith was a prophet. Like, I mean, obviously that leader probably has that testimony, but the fact that maybe they struggle with some question of, now I was in, you know, Doctrine and Covenants 11, and I read this verse and I just couldn't reconcile it. And it just stuck with me. I wrestled with it over and over again, right? And just seeing that leader taking a vulnerable moment that he doesn't know at all, like he approaches the gospel similar to what I do, and that's okay. You know, when the leader starts with vulnerability, it becomes contagious, and that's helpful.
Yeah.
What about, so it sounds like just as far as the purpose of the book, you wanted to create a well-rounded resource, you know, and I love the ministering in the subtitle, ministering to those who question, like, and that's, I mean, right now, everybody, ministering has been announced, that, you know, the new quote unquote program, we're still sort of figuring it out, what it looks like. And so I appreciate that this is a place that we can minister to. It's not that we don't just minister to those that need their house painted or their garbage taken out, but sometimes they're in the midst of a struggle and we need to understand how to minister for them. And so this sort of sounds like, I don't know if handbook is the right word or a book to give you perspective on maybe how to start to begin to approach some of those ministering relationships when sometimes they're really uncomfortable to even begin that dialogue.
Yeah. When the switch from home and visiting teaching came over to ministering, we've had a lot of talks about it. I have found that the majority of the content of those talks is motivational. You know, we need to do it. It's important. We bless lives. There are a few times when there's a skill set that is taught about how to minister. And I think in some settings, we're really very good at ministering. You know, when there's a health challenge or a tragedy, a loss of life, or, you know, an economic problem, I think we know how to minister there pretty well. I think some of these other areas, and some of them are related to faith and some are not, are just harder for us to minister to because we usually haven't thought through all the skills we need to in order to be able to be effective there. And it could be someone who's lost faith, could be someone who has mental health issues, could be someone who's going through a divorce and not knowing how to kind of navigate the complex interpersonal issues that might happen inside a ward. And so I welcome any additional help that is brought to our community of saints on how to minister, because I think the skill set is something that the Lord wants us to learn. And it's in essence foundational to the kind of change moving from home and visiting teaching, which can be mechanical, to being ministerial, which is much more pastoral and loving.
Yeah. And I love that you emphasize that. This is like one of my big leadership tenets is that oftentimes we confuse an ability problem with a motivational problem. We think, man, or even those that are, you know, wrestling with their faith and they're wondering, why doesn't the bishop want to come talk to me? Or why doesn't anybody talk to me when I go to church? And we think they have a motivational problem, when in reality, they don't know what to do. They don't have the ability to go and do that. And so I appreciate a book like this where you can sort of get down to the ability side of it. You know, here's some things you can say, or here's something to consider. And that increases the ability of individuals so that they can follow through with the motivation they do have. They want to be that person who ministers regardless of what they're dealing with, but they sometimes don't have the ability. So it's easier to sort of avoid it altogether.
Yeah. Or we confuse, you know, there's a lot of confusion that can happen here. I interviewed a lot of people for this book and I include some of their stories, and their stories of people who either are struggling or have left the church. And it's interesting, in many of those interviews that I did, at the end of the interview, the person would say, "Dave, thanks for taking the time to listen to me. Mm-hmm. No one has ever asked me why I no longer believe." And that surprised me. It surprised me that someone who had been, you know, a perfectly faithful member of the church, struggled through a faith crisis, resolved it by leaving the church, that no one ever asked them why. And what was interesting was how important it was for that person to be understood.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing, I always go back to that. It's, we always feel like it's about having the right answer, but you don't have to have the right answer. You just have to have the conversation. And sometimes those are tough to have. And so it takes some understanding of how to do that to to actually carry it forward. Because like you said, there's so much confusion and misunderstanding. It's not that we don't even get to the root of the problem or the root of the topic to talk about, because we're just sort of have misconceptions, and it just doesn't ever work out well in that state. You know, what about anything else as far as like what you learned from the book or through the process of the book that you weren't expecting that maybe we should cover before we move on? And if there's not, that's fine too.
So one thing I kind of knew before, but writing the book allowed me to both develop that kind of meager understanding into something that was more systematic, is how people are so different. You know, like, duh, everyone's different, right? But the implications of that, I don't think I had fully understood. So one aspect of difference was generational. You know, I'm in my 60s. I'm a boomer. My youth and my testimony was formed in the 60s and the 70s. And there were particular issues that were going on in society and in my life that formed my testimony, the things that were important to me, I found answers for, but they aren't the same things that others find important to answer. I'm a white guy from an upper middle class environment with lots of education. I'm not a millennial. I'm not a minority. I'm not a woman. You know, I don't suffer from mental illness. So my experience and the way in which I perceive faith clearly is through the culture of the way I was raised. And as I have expanded my view by talking to other people and reading more and listening, I find that whether it's generational or gender-based or based on sexual identity or wealth or national origin, or you pick your difference, we are all different. And even though there are commonalities, there are also differences. And I sometimes lost sight of those differences as I ministered in my other callings, because I didn't appreciate the importance of understanding those differences and the blind spots that I might have had because my culture, you know, my who I am and my life experience is so different than someone else.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, and you have a chapter that's called How Societal Changes Affect Belief, because it's, I think, an easy trap to fall into as an Orthodox leader. And I'm just thinking of a leader who's in his 50s and 60s to think, well, I remember when I had questions when I was in my 20s, you know, and you sort of get in this mode of saying, well, this is how I approached it and overcame these questions. But, you know, that was in the maybe the 70s or 80s, where it was a different world with different information and different resources at your ability. So talk to us about the motivation about having this chapter about societal changes, and what are those societal changes and how do they affect belief?
Well, I think if we don't understand where someone is coming from, it's very difficult for us to minister to them. And reflecting that today is a different day is just essential to do that. So, you know, pick a topic, the internet. So when I grew up, if I wanted to understand historical issues, you know, I really had to go to a library and consult an expert. And today I can Google and I can find a wealth of information, most of which is really even reliable, a historical topic. And I've used the internet enough to know how to kind of judge, at least a pretty good judge, on whether the article I'm looking at can be relied upon. And so when I grew up, my authority figures, I felt like I could really trust them. And they were the only sources for me to go to. And today, youth growing up and youth who have grown up in the internet age have less trust in institutional leaders and more kind of personal trust in their self in terms of being able to go out, sort through information, and understand what is important or right or important, or, you know, that they should focus on. So, you know, just something like that is different. Another issue, I grew up in the later part of the Vietnam era. You know, I was in high school during Watergate. I recall Martin Luther King being assassinated. I recalled and saw the rise of women seeking equality in a very organized and forceful way. I saw kind of a global fight between the Western world and communism. And so my world was kind of formed that way. And yet, you know, someone who's a millennial today has weathered the Great Recession, something that impacted me, you know, it did, but it didn't impact me when I was trying to establish myself. So there's a level of perhaps insecurity, perhaps concern about financial institutions and the stability of society that I just don't feel in a way that millennials often do feel. I left college with a little bit of debt. That's because I went to an expensive business school. You know, kids who end up graduating from those same schools or even just undergraduate can have a ton of debt, and it can take them years and years and years to pay off. So just the security issues that I felt versus what they felt. So there's all sorts of kind of differences that are there. You know, I was raised in a traditional family with traditional gender roles. My daughters were raised in a society without those traditions. I mean, we had a traditional family in our home, but all around them, you know, they saw different ways in which women and families are organized. And because of that, they have a different worldview. So I don't know. These are just a few, and I could kind of keep going on. Yeah. But, you know, the listeners probably get the point.
Yeah, and I think that's so helpful. Just that, and I think a different dynamic is that, you know, generally speaking, I felt, again, I was born in 82, so I don't remember the 70s and all, but generally speaking, the 70s and 80s, there's this feeling where you could really lock down doctrine and lock down facts. Like, this is the way it is. It was much easier to get to a point where you felt like things were black and white. But now, like you said, we have a world of information, and sometimes that information comes from experts that know what they're talking about. Sometimes they don't, and it's everything in the middle where it can sort of, it's harder to lock down, you know, what's a good resource and what's not. And then the minute you say this is a good resource, you know, maybe someone from the younger generation can start seeing holes in that resource, right? And then that trust goes down, and then it just sort of builds on itself that it becomes more difficult. So I appreciate this perspective of just stepping back and realizing, okay, I need to be proactive in maybe grabbing a resource like this book or others and figuring out how I can better relate to their experience and understand their experience so that we can at least have that conversation. Again, not to have the answer and to solve all their concerns, but at least begin to have the question because I think we all know that it's so difficult to have a deep, meaningful conversation if the other person in the conversation, you know, does not understand me. So what's the point? You know, and so it's easier just to leave that conversation and go elsewhere until you find that conversation, right?
Yeah, I feel like underneath some of the issues that present challenges to faith today, there is an underlying thread of trust. Can I trust my leaders either to tell me what I ought to be doing or how to navigate the challenges that I feel in my life? And where a leader chooses to use very simplistic, generalized approaches to faith, that individual is going to lose trust pretty quickly. And it doesn't need for the leader to get a PhD, you know, or read, you know, every possible thing. But what it means is that someone can trust that they will listen, that they will accept their concerns as valid, that they will work with them to the best of their limitations to be able to help them. And that's a whole lot better of a place for a relationship to come from. And the leader that says, I think these are the words of Marlon Jensen, you know, ignore that, get back and do your home and visiting teaching.
Yeah.
That the simplistic answers aren't always the ones that get us through. We should do, you know, our ministering, and we should read the scriptures and pray. But sometimes we need more than that to be able to navigate these issues. And having a trusted leader who is invested in that person is so much a part of the journey that is effective.
Yeah. I love that. And then we've talked a lot about, like, if anybody's listening thinking, okay, well, what's the nuts and bolts? Like, how do I do that? That's where we've talked about in a lot of our past conversations about showing empathy and love and listening and, you know, what to say, what not to say, generally speaking. But I'm curious, you know, as you went through this project with your experience as a bishop, as a stake president, as a mission president, what did you, if you could go back in time and instruct yourself or give yourself some tips, what do you wish you knew as a leader that you know now?
Yeah, you know, this is a sobering question for me. I often wake up in the middle of the night and remember a situation which I really flubbed. And, you know, almost all of the flubs were out of ignorance. sometimes out of effort, sometimes out of motivation, but usually because I just didn't know better. You know, I was young, I was inexperienced, I just didn't know. And the things, I would have done things differently in two ways. One is, personally, a leader is a minister. You know, we don't use the word pastor in our church, but there is a pastoral role of working with a person and helping them where they are. And, you know, none of my life experience had given me a lot of experience into how to do that well. And I think we're best when we sit in with someone and we put away our agenda and we say, my goal here is not to have this person come back to church. My goal isn't for them to set aside their concern of a particular issue. I am there to just listen and to be present. And listening in that sense is really very active. It's instead of praying for the right scripture to say to rebut their problem, it means praying to know what is at the heart of their concern, praying for insight to be able to see things the way they see them. And if we can get in that mode, and it's really hard, at least it is for me. Yeah. I think some people are wired better. I'm a business guy. I'm impatient. You know, I've got, you know, results
a list of interviews and appointments to get to.
You know, the agenda's rich. But I have found that if I set that aside, that natural part of myself, and just say, I just want to understand, not the words that come out of your mouth, but what is in your heart. Because the words coming out of their mouth are often not what is exactly in their heart. And that means that I need to learn to ask questions. And I've learned that I fumble in those questions because I don't know how to ask them always particularly well. But I learned that if I really put an effort out to try and listen, that the person will cut me slack when I make, you know, when I don't ask the question quite right. And they forgive me for my clumsiness or my inadequacy. And so I've learned to be, you know, bolder about saying, I'm not here to try and get you to come back to church. I just want to understand. I just want to understand what's in your heart. Tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me about your struggles.
Yeah, that's such a powerful skill, and it does take some practice, and it's very difficult in the beginning, and makes me think of one of my favorite communication and leadership books is Crucial Conversations by the people at Vital Smarts, and they talk about this concept of when there's like an intense conversation that needs to happen that maybe feels risky, vulnerable, like to take a moment and step out of the conversation or out of the topic of the conversation and just address the fact that I feel uncomfortable. I don't want to act like I have all the answers. I just want to understand. And that gives you a level of foundation to actually move forward with the conversation. And it feels like the trust level just shoots up and they think, oh, this is a leader I can be honest with. And he just wants to understand. So I can say almost anything here.
Yeah, and I found that for me at least, and I think this is true for many people, that there is an element in the leader, the parent, of fear. You know, the fear can be, I don't really want to know. The fear can be, I'm a really bad leader. It's going to show. The fear could be in a family where, what does this do to what I have perceived I want for my family? And that all of those feelings of fear or inadequacy are all about me instead of about the person that I'm trying to build a relationship with. And so when I let that fear about me dominate that conversation, then it does become a me versus them kind of situation. And there isn't that unity or that understanding that I think our Heavenly Father would want us to have.
Yeah. And I love this conversation just about, you know, we've talked about empathy going one way to the, you know, you want to show a lot of empathy to what they're going through. But sometimes, you know, you're talking about the flubs of leadership that after leadership, after you're released, you like, they just come back to haunt you sometimes. And so there's got to be a level of just empathy, self-empathy towards yourself saying, you know, nobody expects me to be the perfect leader. I may say something I regret, but as long as the person knows that my heart's in the right place, they're going to be more forgiving. And nobody's going to get me in trouble if I just have this conversation and sort of put that aside, like you said, like take those fears of what, how's this conversation going to affect me as a leader? What if I mess this up? You know, what if somebody else finds, interprets this that I'm condoning certain behaviors, or like just set all that aside and have a real conversation. And it is a liberating process.
Yeah, agreed. Well said.
What about in raising your family? You know, obviously another leadership role is being a father. And what in the context of just being a father and obviously promoted faith, growing, raising your children and so forth, how has it impacted you as a father?
Yeah, I'm in a good place on this now. As I say in the book, I have six wonderful children, some of whom don't believe in, you know, as they used to, and I'm just fine with that. I have things that are really important to me, and I'm grateful that there's things that are important to them, and they're good things. And I have patience and hope in what I believe, and that fear that perhaps I used to have there doesn't pervade my thinking or my relationship. If I kind of go back in time, I think our family did some things really well, but I think we could have improved in a couple of areas. I think I could have done a better job of creating a space to discuss hard things. And, you know, his parents are busy. We had six kids. We also were raising two foster children. We lived 85 miles away from the stake center when I was the stake president.
Wow.
So, you know, our lives were full. There wasn't, you know, a lot of spare time. And so we were running the ship with order. I wish I had taken more time to stop and really create a setting where individually with my children, I could better understand what they were experiencing. There's some things I missed. And there's some things that if I would have known about, I could have been more helpful as a father. And I just kind of got in like the river of the church where, you know, we did all the things of the church, you know, young men, young women, seminary, primary, you know, all of our callings, you know, all those things. But I wish I would have seen that that is something that supports me in my individual responsibility to my children, as opposed to something I can rely upon to accomplish the things as a parent that I really should be. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, because especially the Latter-day Saint model and the model that the church gives us is so, it's effective and it's so structured that sometimes we just default to the model, right? And to the point where we've defaulted to the model for 20 years in raising children that suddenly there hasn't been stopping points where tough conversations were needed or tough conversations were prompted, right? And so just being proactive of having tough conversations early on, I mean, that's where my mind is going with a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. Like, obviously, I'm not having deep conversations about faith development in that context, but there's a lot of topics where I could have difficult conversations so that when that phase in their development comes, they know that I'm the type of dad that has tough conversations and I'm open to that, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, a general conference talk that comes to mind on this was Elder Bednar's talk at April session. And I didn't count how many times he said it, but you know, he's very thoughtful and specific. And he said a number of times, home-centered, church-supported, right? I mean, you know, just probably said it 5 or 6 times. And I think he said it intentionally to get that drilled in our mind that it's in our home. In some of the surveys that I did, one of the findings that was interesting to me was that leaders felt a higher priority to address faith challenges in their family than they did in their ward. So it's interesting. We think of leaders and think about their responsibility to their ward. But even as aware as they are of these challenges in their ward, all of us as, you know, individuals, as parents, bring that back to our family. We know we'll be released from our ward or state callings. We never want to be released from our family callings.
Yeah, that's fascinating that sometimes it is easier to approach difficult subjects on the family level because it's, you know, it's much more micro, right? You're not addressing a large body and different opinions and perspectives, but to be intentional that I need to not only address this in my home, but how can I address this in the ward community as well, right?
So, you know, here's just an example. We have the gospel topics essays, right? And they address some of the harder historical or doctrinal challenges of the church. It's not uncommon for a missionary to have not read those before their mission and to go out in front of an investigator and to be teaching something and have the investigator Google something and say, oh, this is the way it was. And the investigator is right and the missionary is wrong because the missionary doesn't know it. So here we put, whether it's as a missionary or at some other point in their life, we put them in a setting where the church has actually given us materials to talk about these issues, but because maybe we're uncomfortable with them or we don't know about them particularly well or because of other issues, we don't bring those to our children, and then we set them up for having problems later on in their lives. And it's not just gospel topics essays. It's, you know, whatever is on the mind of our children. And knowing that the Gen Z, I think that's, you know, you've got kids in the Gen Z, don't you?
Yep, for sure. And,
you know, I don't know what's going to be important to them in their life, but it's a whole lot different than boomers when I was a kid, right? So you're going to need to think about what's important to them and how do you address it and whether it's going to be poverty or inequality or lack of opportunity. You know, those are going to be issues that will be on their mind.
Yeah. And I just love the idea of, you know, the Come Follow Me program, you know, as Elder Bednar says, like home focused, church supported.
Oh, is that what it is? I got it wrong.
Well, what did you say it was? I think you got it right.
I said home-centered, gospel, home-centered. Church right. supported.
Yeah, home-centered, well, church maybe. Supported. People know what we mean nonetheless.
Yeah.
But sometimes we think, okay, we have to go to that chapter of the week and Come Follow Me, and we can only stay in Acts or we can only stay in Mark, you know, and we'll discuss that. But what a great platform that we've been encouraged to create that any question or topic can be tackled. And if you spend a few weeks on something that's really prominent in the life of your teenager or loved one that doesn't happen to be in the book of Acts or Romans, then that's okay, right? That's the process that we want to make these organic and natural conversations so that the habit of having conversations is happening in our home.
Yeah, I mean, I go back in my own life, and I was raised well. I had good parents. I don't ever recall talking about an issue that was probably one of the biggest issues for me, and that was race in the priesthood. You know, I was I graduated from high school, and, you know, African-American saints couldn't hold the priesthood. I came back from my mission, and they could. And it was a real difficult issue for me. I don't think I ever talked about that in my family. And, you know, I struggled and I got through it, but I wish that there was a space natural for me to have talked about that. And I'm sure my children feel the same thing about a different topic, maybe even one I don't know about, because, you know, I didn't ask them and give them the opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. Man, and there's probably a parent listening to this in the car right now. Maybe they have earbuds in or whatever. But like sometimes I know my life can be so consumed with media sometimes that those long car rides, you don't, they don't become as beneficial as they were for when I was a child. So finding those opportunities to just, you know, put the earbuds down and to come back to it later and ask some questions or start a conversation. But again, the Come Follow Me structure just builds that in. What a wonderful opportunity that is. So, well, I don't know, David, anything else we're missing? I mean, obviously people need to jump into the book and we're not here to cover every point of the book. Hopefully people go out and read it, but anything you wish I would have asked or we talked about before we wrap up?
You know, Kurt, whenever we do these interviews, we know we could go on for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And you and I might want to do that. And I have the time and you don't, and our listeners don't have the time. So, you know, this is probably a good place to end. You know, my hope and my dream on this is that we can have richer relationships. In my book, I tell a story about a woman I name Amanda. And, you know, Amanda's probably your age, and she no longer comes to church. And in that interview, she talks about how she knows that her mother is no longer proud of her. Mm. So I hope that, and everything I know about Amanda says anyone would be prepped for. So I hope that in this kind of a book setting and in the conversations that are already happening, there's other people talking about this, that we give more respect, more space, more love and accepting to a person like Amanda. And, you know, she may never, probably doesn't ever come back to the church, but she is a good person with good values that was taught well by her parents. So I'm hopeful that the book can create those conversations. There aren't simple answers. You know, we can listen, but when we listen and hear the issue, then the hard work has to happen. And that hard work, you know, is something we pray about. It's something we counsel about. It's something we study. And in that process, I hope it changes us as an individual so that we develop more skill around ministering and around accepting people. So that's my hope, Kurt.
That concludes my interview with David Osler. A big shout out to him for sitting down with me through the powers of the internet and having this discussion. I implore you, go check out this resource that he's put together, this book called Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question. Now they're in the process of getting it on the shelves of, you know, your well-known Latter-day Saint bookstores like Deseret Book and others. But if obviously the go-to whenever looking for a book is Amazon. It's on Amazon, available for download on Kindle, or you have a physical copy sent to you. Also, that he just finished, at the time of this recording, just finished recording the audiobook of this resource. And so you can find that on Audible. And I don't know where else people get audiobooks other than Audible. So start there. And the audio version is available. But such a fantastic resource and important on this theme. And I'll probably mention at the very end that Questioning Saints is there. The library's there. We've recorded it. We're still adding. Over time, we'll continue to add sessions and conversations to that. And so it's worth going there, gaining access to that resource. And remember, text the word LEAD to 474747, and we'll send you more information about the Questioning Saints Virtual Summit.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.